Plant Friend, I'm so excited to bring you this Best of Growing Joy series way back, throwback episode to 2020. In the pandemic, Plant Friends, I let my plant nerd freak flag fly extremely high. New York Botanical Garden had only exclusively in-person classes at the Botanical Garden in the Bronx. And in the pandemic, they brought those classes online. I took every class they had to offer. I took soil science, plant science 101, and also this class on tree communication with a professor that I really loved. Her name is Dr. L. Barnes, and she gave this really fascinating class on the secret world of plant communication, particularly trees. So this is the replay of the episode that I did with her after taking her course because I was so fascinated. I just found her entire course so incredible and awe-inspiring that I wanted to bring at least a little sliver of the course to our community. And so once again, a couple years later, I wanted to bring it back in case you might have missed this way, way, way down the feed. In this conversation, Dr. Barnes and I explore the wild world of the wood wide web and how plants use fungi and VOCs, volatile organic compounds, to communicate with each other. It's going to blow your mind. You're never going to look at trees the same. So buckle up. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
The first time we met, you weren't a doctor quite yet. So we call you Elle, but I have to keep saying Dr. Barnes. So our community probably remembers you from the unbelievable conversation that we had on the mind-blowing facts that we learned in Plant Science 101 with New York Botanical Garden. But I'm so excited to have you back after another round of mind-blowing facts of the science of tree communication.
Yeah, I mean, I think the science of tree communication, besides the plant science class, is one of my favorite classes to teach because it's just an area of science that a lot of people just don't know anything about. But there's so many interesting things that trees and just plants in general are doing that we don't even realize.
Oh my God. I mean, I go for a walk in my new home. I go for a walk in the woods every morning. And the concept of the wood wide web has like changed my walks in the woods. Like truly, it's given me such a deeper appreciation for the ecosystem and communication that's happening between plants. So I think that we're going to go into some mind-blowing facts about trees at the end of this episode. But I think for our plant parent community, the most interesting thing to talk about is how plants communicate, because that's really what this class was about. The fact that plants are communicating with each other invisibly all the time. We don't know what's going on. And it's really interesting. And also, I think has kind of been branded in a weird way in the houseplant community. And I'm ready for you to set us straight. So let's just dive right in. So VOCs were a big thing we talked about and the main vehicle for communication for plants. So what is a VOC?
Yeah, okay. So VOCs are part of the above ground plant communication system, right? Because plants, you know, they have the above ground part with the stem and leaves, and then they have the underground part, which we'll talk about, I think, a little later. But so VOCs stand for volatile organic compounds. And all that really means is that it's an organic molecule, which means it has lots of carbons and lots of hydrogens. And it's volatile, which means that it easily can evaporate as a gas, right? So they're gaseous organic molecules. And VOCs basically are these messengers that plants can emit, or really a number of chemicals can be converted into these VOCs, as long as they contain carbons and hydrogens. But plants emit them to communicate with themselves and also potentially with one another.
Okay, so let's break that down. How does a plant use a VOC to communicate with itself?
Yeah, so if we think about how a plant is organized, body parts kind of all over the place, and it might experience damage in one part of its body, and it wants to communicate to another part of its body that I'm experiencing damage here and I might need some help, or you might want to prepare yourself because the insect causing the damage might spread. And doing that, sending a message all the way through the plant is extremely costly because it has to go through a number of cells and a number of different tissues. And actually, it's much quicker for the plant to just release a chemical into the air that then surrounds all of the tissues of the plant and can be reabsorbed into the plant from another part, right? So it's just a quicker communication system rather than going from cell to cell to cell to cell.
Because when the VOCs are inside the plant, are they still gaseous? Because when they get released out of the plant, they get released in gas form. But yes. How do they exist within the plant?
Usually liquid reserves. And so in a number of parts of the leaves or in anything that you might have heard of called a trichome, which are usually like those little leaf hairs that a number of plants can have. A lot of times those actually contain these little vesicles that hold some kind of liquid communication system, basically a pre-VOC, right? So it's not volatile. Mm-hmm. It is an organic molecule, but it's not volatile yet because it's not exposed to the air.
Okay, so it becomes a VOC once it gets released. So if the top of my head is getting eaten by a bug, I'll release a VOC to send a message to my foot if I'm a plant.
Yes.
To say, hey, the bug is eating my head, prepare yourself. And then what would my foot do? Like, what would another part of a plant do?
Yeah. So one thing is that anytime a plant throughout its lifespan, it needs to make a decision. It has to face a trade-off between growth, right? And succeeding in that environment, and then just maintaining the status quo or preventing itself from getting damaged by an insect or a predator. And so each of those things costs energy and costs carbon basically to the plant. And so they need to make that decision. And so they are not constantly making these protective chemicals. Instead, what happens is a lot of VOCs can be received in one part of the plant and they can then tell those cells to upregulate or produce more of that protective chemical. I think one way you could potentially think about it is that when you get a mosquito bite, right? Imagine if when you got in a mosquito bite and it, you know, it turns red, and the reason it turns red is because the cells of your immune system is signaling inflammation there, right? So it's creating a number of chemicals that are causing inflammation. But imagine if immediately after receiving that mosquito bite, you release a pheromone or a gas, a VOC, that could then protect the rest of your body from getting mosquito bites.
God, I'm so allergic to mosquitoes, but that's essentially it. It would be the rest of my body like giving off DEET almost. Mm-hmm. Wow. Who can figure that out for humans? I need that. So the interesting thing in taking the science of tree communication with you, my biggest mind-blowing takeaway is that VOCs are friendly. VOCs are helpful, like the air and phonation of my voice to communicate with you. Like it's as necessary as that. And in the houseplant world, everybody is hung up on whether or not plants clean the air. And we've talked about this a little bit in our last episode, but I want to dive in. There was this NASA study a while ago in the 80s that proved in these like very controlled situations that plants, quote unquote, clean the air. And in that, neutralize VOCs. And so in the houseplant world, because that's the kind of language that gets communicated to us, I've been conditioned to think that all VOCs are bad and VOCs are swirling around the air and they're giving me cancer and they're really bad. And the plant's job is to like basically absorb the VOC and clean the air that way. And through this class, that's just like not the case. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, this like misconception about VOCs is because scientifically, the term VOC is really broad. It's really broad. And there are many, many, many chemicals that can be classified as VOCs because all it has to do is be organic and then be able to be a gas. Any chemical that's organic and then be a gas is basically considered a VOC. So that's how general the term is. The problem really with like human health and VOCs is that VOCs are not necessarily very stable molecules. So they readily react with other things that are in our atmosphere or in the air that we're breathing. And when those things interact with one another, they produce a new chemical that can be very damaging to our health.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And so basically plants use or produce VOCs and use them to either communicate with themselves or potentially other plants. And that's always kind of been happening in the background. The problem is now is that a number of other things that we do in our environment as humans produce a number of artificial or other VOCs. And now the total amount of VOCs has drastically increased. And so it's more likely that we're going to get these secondary things that result from VOCs interacting with these other things we're putting in the environment.
Okay. And that makes sense because a lot of people talk about like my computer and my carpet and my drapes, they're giving off those VOCs that, you know, I want neutralized. So what's the difference between like a VOC that comes off of a plant and a VOC that like comes out of my carpet?
Yeah. So the basis of the structure of the VOC is going to be different, and there's many different families of VOCs. And oftentimes the VOCs that come from your carpets or your drapes or something like that are the result of the chemical process that's used to make those items. And over time, they become released because the item becomes worn, essentially, or reacts with other things that are in the air. The difference with plants is that plants produce them in very, very small amounts unless they need to use them for something, right? So a plant is really just not just sitting there releasing VOCs constantly. They're really only going to release them when they experience damage or they need to use them to communicate some other kind of signal. So there's going to be spurts of production of VOCs, right? Because it costs something for that plant to produce that chemical. Kind of the difference is the total amount and the timing at which they're released.
What about absorption? Because that plants, you know, the whole conversation about plants neutralize and or absorb the bad VOCs in the air.
Yeah. So when they say that plants can neutralize or absorb things, right, that requires that that plant has essentially a receptor to receive that message, right? So you could kind of think about it as different languages, right? We could hear someone speaking Spanish, but unless you also spoke Spanish and could understand Spanish, you might hear it, but you don't understand the message and you don't absorb the message, right? And so that's similar to what's happening to plants, is there are many, many VOCs that plants could be experiencing, but they're actually not interacting or absorbing them because they don't have receptors to translate them.
Okay. But in this NASA study, which is interesting, I mean, I hope they're doing more since then.
There are a lot of studies that are still working on that.
There are. Okay, good. Because I'm ready for like the next wave of it. But some of those bad ones, there are plants that can. I mean, the whole NASA study was like this whole chart of like all the different plants on one side of the chart and then all the different VOCs on the other side of the chart. And then you see like the areca palm absorbs this one and this one and this one, but not this one and this one and this one.
Right.
So I guess that's where that comes from, that the plants just coincidentally do have the receptors.
Yeah. I mean, I think they coincidentally do have the receptors. Also, depending on the plant, like life history or how the plant actually grows and absorbs things, they could absorb different amounts of a chemical, right? Like, so they could take in more of the total amount of a VOC than a different species of plant. And the major caveat with that study is that the air exchange in that study was basically zero, right? It was like they were in an isolated chamber. And so there was no constant flow of new VOCs coming through the air. And so actually, right, you'd have to have a lot of plants in your house to clear all the VOCs. And you could do that much more simply by opening your window, because the rate of air exchange is much faster just through an open window than it is through the plant tissue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess then the argument there is like, if you live in New York City, you open your window and you're also letting in new VOCs from like pollution and in the cars. It's just a lose-lose. But yeah, I mean, I think just understanding those studies more, I don't think having plants in your house is going to make your air dirtier.
No.
Like, they're certainly neutralizing them a little bit, but I think it is important to understand that that NASA study that everyone bases, and I'm guilty of this early on in my career as a podcaster, also preaching this to people. I mean, there are books that I've read, Why Do Plants Clean Air? You know, the one from the 80s. Yeah, like, it's important to understand, unless you're in this like airtight container, that study isn't necessarily going to apply to your apartment. Even though if you have a lot of plants in your apartment, it's going to be a little more humid. Maybe there is a little bit less VOCs. You're also just going to be like a generally happier person because you're surrounded by plants. So like it's a win-win.
Yeah. And that's kind of the conclusion of a lot of these studies. They were hoping to show that that plants really do clean the air. And their conclusion oftentimes is, okay, so maybe they're not doing what we really thought they were doing at the level that we thought they were cleaning the air.
Yeah.
But the process of having a plant and taking care of a plant, those benefits are tremendous. And so, yes, we should still have plants in our house.
Right. Like we're sold on it, but not the cleaning the air part, which is super interesting. Okay. So we know we've busted that myth, and also just kind of understanding these, like that there are good VOCs and bad VOCs, but that more importantly than cleaning the air, like they're the way plants communicate with each other. So in the natural world, why are VOCs so important?
VOCs kind of do two main things. They serve two main purposes. One is to communicate damage or that a predator is near. And the other is to do kind of the opposite, which is to actually attract pollinators.
Okay.
And that's really why flowers have a smell. Roses smell like roses. The rose smell, that's the VOC that the flower is giving off to attract very specific pollinators. Of course, how we interpret that scent is different than how another insect might interpret that scent, but it's essentially that's the goal of why flowers have these very unique smells, is that's the VOC to attract the pollinator.
Yes. Okay. So this was a huge mind-blowing moment for me. So basically, most of the smells that we know as being natural smells, lavender, rose, eucalyptus, fresh cut grass, are all actually our interpretation of a certain type of VOC. Just like you said, the fresh cut grass moment was in class for me, like a mind-blowing moment. So can you talk about how everybody loves that fresh cut grass smell, but what is it actually?
Yeah. So the smell of fresh cut grass is, well, it's a number of chemicals, actually, but it is the release of VOCs from the grass, the little grass organisms. Essentially, a lot of them are in this family called the green leaf volatiles. And basically, they're a response of the grass to other grass individuals nearby that I'm under attack, right? So when you mow your lawn and you're essentially kind of deheading the tops of your grass, the smell that's released is the VOC to signal to other grass, we're experiencing danger. Of course, grass doesn't realize that it's being mowed, in which case all the grass individuals are going to be damaged. But it's a remnant or a leftover trait from insects, right? Herbivory from a number of insects. And so when the grass experiences damage from insects or even herbivores like deer, other grass nearby can receive the VOC and then produce other chemicals that make the grass taste bad, right? To get the deer to stop eating it. Right. So
by releasing, I'm a blade of fresh cut grass and you're a blade a foot away from me, I get mowed or I get eaten by some herbivore and I emit my VOC. It gets sent over to you. You receive it and you go, oh shit, danger. And you actually change the way you taste, knowing that when you get bit, that herbivore isn't going to like how you taste. And then therefore you're actually kind of sacrificed. You're hoping you don't get bit, but then the other blades around you. So I told this story to my dad. Part of having this podcast is like, I learn things and tell them to my family and they're like, shut up, Maria. But I told this story to my dad and he was like, cool story, Maria, but like, how do they know that that's the grass? How do they know the VOC is that purpose? Like, how is that measured? Because it's not like the grass is telling us that that's what they're doing. So how do we even understand that?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways that scientists have tried to figure this out. And essentially what happens is they can grow grass in a controlled setting like a laboratory. They can physically or mechanically damage the grass with scissors. And they can collect the gaseous molecules that are produced, right? When the grass is cut versus when the grass is not cut. And then they can expose new grass to the chemicals that were captured under these different treatments and see how that grass then responds.
Okay. So it's about collecting and measuring. And then I guess, is it also about like observing I guess, like, if we're going back to the you, me analogy, like measuring how you changed your own taste.
Yep.
Okay. But there are scientific studies that like back all of this up, right?
Yeah. And of course, this is one thing to say is that the field of plant communication, or I think a lot of scientists would be more comfortable calling it plant eavesdropping. Although it's been talked about for a long time, it's only recently been revived. And so there are a lot of studies now that are looking into the molecular mechanisms that cause plants to do certain things. And we found out that they have this communication system. And there's just been a lot more research more recently on this topic.
Have you read The Overstory yet?
I haven't.
I was lucky enough, just coincidentally, to have finished it right before I started class with you. And it's the most unbelievable book I've ever read. Like, it's a long book, but I couldn't put it down. Like, I would be laying in bed next to my fiance with my iPhone flashlight on because I couldn't put it down. But anyway, one of the characters in the book is this like fictional character based off of the first scientist who started studying plant communication. And it talks about how she went through the process of like capturing VOCs. And it's just so cool. If anyone likes trees, you must read this book. It's so beautiful. I'll leave a link in the show notes. But anyway, so fresh cut grass, VOC.
Yes.
Rose, the smell of rose. Yeah. VOC.
Yeah.
Lavender, VOC.
Yes.
What other ones? I mean, it's just like everything of VOC.
Basically, lemon scented cleaning products, VOC. The like, smell of a beer, right? VOC. Basil, VOC, cinnamon, VOC, lilac.
Okay, so those smells that are constantly emitted, basil, if I could wear basil perfume, I would. It's my favorite smell in the whole world. So you mentioned those are all about attracting pollinators. So let's talk about VOCs and pollinators and why that's important.
Yeah, so there's a unique trait to having flowers, right? So not all plants have flowers. Only the angiosperms have flowers. It's a fairly recent adaptation based on the tree of life, but it serves a number of benefits. But one of those benefits is that we could have more outcrossing, or essentially we limit the likelihood that any one plant is going to reproduce with its close relatives, right? So we get more genetic diversity. And the way that plants with flowers have done that is they create lures, a reproductive assistant, aka a pollinator. And the pollinator comes, it's attracted by the smell of the flower. It then stays for the nectar, right? The sugary liquid. In staying for the nectar, it inherently gets covered in pollen, and then it goes on to the next plant, and it'll deposit that pollen onto that other flower, right? So they're facilitating reproduction,
essentially. Spread of pollen. Right. And the VOCs are responsible for that because the VOC smell is what attracts that bee. So is there different VOCs for different bugs? Like, are there some bugs that don't like some VOCs and some that do? Like, how does the hierarchy of that work?
We definitely think that can be true, that there are a number of bugs that either are deterred by certain VOCs or they just aren't attracted to them. Like they don't have a receptor to receive that smell. And so they just pass right by it because they're not attracted to it at all. And that's kind of what we think might be happening in a number of cases, especially in like large natural settings with lots of wildflowers. Insect can become very overwhelmed with all of the scents that could be emitted. And so it makes sense that they'd be very specific or very well tuned to certain VOCs over others. And this is thought to be the result of coevolution, where essentially a plant and an insect have co-evolved together because they form such a tight and important relationship, because it's due to the insect being able to survive and then the plant being able to reproduce, that they've become so intertwined that they almost become one working system, right? And that's the problem with when you remove certain plants from an ecosystem, that it also infects the insects.
Right. Okay. And then you talked a lot about the enemy of my enemy.
Yes. Yeah. That's one of the coolest things that I think has started to come out of a number of these plant studies, is looking at what happens when, in all those cases where, okay, we see a plant get damaged by some insect, a caterpillar or some kind of worm, and we measure the VOCs, but the VOCs don't seem to have any effect on the herbivore, And the scientists got, because VOCs are expensive to make, so why would this plant make this VOC if it doesn't have any effect on the actual herbivore? And so this is where this idea of indirect resistance comes in, is that essentially that VOC, instead of directly affecting the predator, that caterpillar, it's actually attracting the predator of the caterpillar. So the plant makes a VOC not specific to the caterpillar, but to attract another insect, a larger insect, or perhaps even maybe a bird. There's been some instances where birds can be very well tuned to certain VOCs of plants, and they come over and deal with the insect for the plant, essentially by eating the insect so it stops the predation on the plant.
Okay. So a plant is attracting. So if the enemy was the caterpillar, the enemy of the enemy, by pulling that enemy in, the thought is the herbivore is going to eat the caterpillar and hopefully not eat the plant.
Yeah, like predatory insect or bird is going to eat the herbivore that's eating the plant.
Right.
Yep.
That's so interesting and smart. Like, that's creepy smart.
Yeah. And there's a number of thoughts. Why would that even be necessarily beneficial? Why would that secondary insect be well tuned to another plant's VOC when they technically aren't directly in an interaction with that plant? But the idea would be is that they've probably behaviorally or over evolutionary time have learned that when they receive that VOC, it means there's lots of food nearby. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to follow the VOC like a little breadcrumb trail to the plant to get the food, right? So it's not like they're associating with, I got to go help my friend the plant. It's more, hey, there's a smorgasbord over here. I'm going to go get all of the worms.
Right. Yeah, that is so cool. It's so interesting. It just, God, the more I learn about plants, the more I fall in love with them on a much like larger scale. Yeah. I've always been in love with all my houseplants, but like it's really, the natural world is just amazing.
Yep.
And what's even more amazing, and I think just the coolest, is VOCs is, like you said, the above ground communication. Underground, the ground that we walk on every day, has this unbelievable and undetectable, what you like to call, or I guess science like to call, the wood wide web, yes, which is basically this network of fungi, right? I'm Italian, so I always want to go fungi, because that's how you say mushrooms in Italian, but of fungi that connect all of our trees and plants to each other.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are many different types of fungi.
Right.
So not every fungi is part of this wood wide web, although they probably likely interact with other fungi and then somehow are part of this network.
And they're good ones and bad.
Yes, good exactly. And bad VOCs. Exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And the most interesting thing that we're learning is scientists for a long time have wondered, how are plants so successful, considering that they can't move? That they have to just be resilient or resistant to whatever comes their way. Mm-hmm. And there are trees like the redwoods and the sequoias that have lived for thousands of years and experienced so many environmental changes. How has that happened? What is their secret? And what we're finding out is that they don't do it alone. And they've invested in a backup system or a relationship with another organism, which are often called mycorrhizal fungi.
Yes. And mycorrhizae is a word we hear a lot in our fertilizer and our soil, that we hear even in the houseplant community. We hear that word mycorrhizae a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think oftentimes people wonder, can my houseplants form mycorrhizae? And certainly your houseplant mycorrhizal network is not going to be as dense as that which is found in the forest, because your plant is isolated in a pot by itself. The other thing is that mycorrhizal networks, because they're this intimate interaction between a plant and a fungus, they take a long time to make, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's actually one of the reasons that you don't want to constantly be repotting your plant, because you're going to break some of these interactions that your plant might form with fungi or even bacteria within the soil, right? Because you're just disrupting, you're physically disrupting the soil space. But yeah, and essentially the plants, right, have to give something to the fungi, and the fungi give something to the plants. And so this is how plants have dealt with living in environments with really limiting conditions. So plants might be limited in their ability to uptake water or their ability to take phosphorus or nitrogen. One thing plants usually aren't limited by is their production of carbon, right? Because plants are one of the few organisms that can make their own food through photosynthesis. Fungi can't make their own food through photosynthesis. They don't photosynthesize. A lot of people get confused because people think fungi are plants. They're actually much more closely related to us as animals than they are to plants. And so that's essentially what happens. The fungi give nitrogen or phosphorus or other limiting nutrients to the plants, and the plants pay them in carbon, like a little mini transaction.
Yeah, they like barter all day long with each other because the fungi might connect two trees or three trees in the same forest. They could also send stuff to each other through the fungi, right?
Yeah, that's the thought.
So freaking cool. So something that we hear a lot about mycorrhizae is that they help plants uptake water and they help plants avoid infection. So how do mycorrhizae actually help plants uptake water?
Yeah. So one of the things is that the main organ that helps plants take up water or really anything from the soil are the roots. But of course, growing roots takes energy and there's a cost benefit analysis to everything. And so the plant essentially does some basic accounting and bookkeeping and realizes it's cheaper for me to give this carbon that I would have used to grow my own roots, to instead use it to grow my fungal partnerships. And fungi are much smaller than plant roots. They can fit in between different crevices and extend much farther. So they can just extend the total soil space that a plant can actually access. And immediately surrounding the roots, they'll continue to take up water through osmosis. But then once the water is greater inside the plant than outside the plant in the soil, that process stops happening. And so there's like this zone of dry soil directly around the plant. And so to get around that, they form these associations with fungi that are beyond that little zone of dry soil so that they can continue to take up water.
So since the mycorrhizae network is so much more expansive than the root system, they're able to literally just go find water when a tree can't because it's in the ground and its roots are as far as its roots are. I mean, it's just so interesting.
Yeah, they're much more coordinated, I think, than people give them credit for.
Truly. Before we go into my mind-blowing facts, like what is, after teaching this course and also just like knowing everything you know, like, what's the most impressive or like mind-blowing thing about VOCs and about trees for you, above and below, one for each?
I think the most mind-blowing thing with VOCs was when I first, one of my favorite smells is the smell of pine trees, which remind me obviously of the holidays. And what's interesting is that the smell of pine trees is produced by this chemical called pinene. So basically a pine VOC. And when it's released, scientists have actually found that the release of this VOC into the atmosphere draws moisture in, basically like the moisture binds to this chemical compound, to create cloud cover over forests. So there's this new space of research looking into, are these evergreen pine forests capable of controlling their own precipitation and their own cloud cover by controlling how much of this VOC they release? So if there's been a long period of drought, could they release more of this VOC that then increases cloud cover around them, eventually producing rain?
Wow.
Right? And which would be crazy, right? And so we don't know that just yet. But that's kind of one of the things that we have these hypotheses. The more we learn about these things, and now we can actually start to test them, right? We didn't know what any of these things actually did before. And so, I mean, if anyone has ever been to the Shenandoah Appalachian region of the U.S., you'll know that the mountains are often called the Blue Ridge Mountains because they appear blue in the distance. And that blue is actually all the pinene that the plants are giving off. That chemical reflects blue light, which creates this blue haze over the mountains. It's all because of this VOC they're releasing. So that's one of my like all-time mind-blowing things. Below ground, I mean, I am a micro enthusiast.
That's really like your specialty is understanding that.
And I think the sphere that we're now getting into, now that we know that there can be good microbes and bad microbes, and that these microbes can associate with these plants, is what's happening between different microbes. So we know that trees might communicate through this network and the microbes are clearly communicating with the trees. But how does a tree select which microbes to partner with? And how can microbes sabotage other microbes to get the carbon for themselves? And that's kind of where this fear is going. Because if we could better understand like how this partnership forms, we could probably figure out how to make more efficient agricultural systems, right? Where we set up the perfect, it's like match.com,
right?
But with trees and microbes.
With
right?
trees and microbes.
Or even with corn and microbes. Right?
Yeah.
To grow more efficient so that we don't have to put a lot of fertilizer into the soil or over water or over irrigate certain things. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the coolest things, I think.
Man, that's amazing. When you think about the long-term effects those studies can have on the sustainability of our planet.
Right.
That's so cool.
And microbes have been around much longer than we have, right?
Totally.
We're only now really discovering all the many things that they really control,
yeah.
which is let a lot of, the more you know, the more you think I'm really not at all like controlling myself. Really, the microbes are my supreme ruler and I'm just like a puppet in there.
in their totally.
But this is one of the things that we're looking into. That's just so fascinating.
It's kind of wild that the research has not been prioritized, that we don't know more at this point. Like, I know that's a whole different conversation, but it's kind of wild that we're not farther advanced in understanding this when we're so far advanced with the internet and, you know, all these other things, but like we haven't invested the time and energy into like figuring that out.
Yeah. Well, and actually the strides we've made in the internet are actually being applied now to the World Wide Web.
Yeah, same, I know that's
same,
so funny.
The same algorithms that like Facebook uses to recommend friends to you. Right? Like a friend of a friend of a friend that you might know. Mm-hmm. Basically, the same mathematical equations that Facebook uses, scientists use to figure out who trees relate with in the World Wide Web, like in the mycorrhizal network.
Wow. That's so cool and scary. That's so interesting. Well, I wanted to go over my mind-blowing facts list, but we really hit a lot of them. The blue haze was one of them. Fresh cut grass was one of them. The smell of flowers was one of them. One thing that came up that actually has nothing to do with VOCs, but it was something that I thought was really interesting, was you said that monsteras, which is like a major houseplant, are conditioned to look for darkness.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? I had not known that.
Yeah, so that was like, we were talking about above ground plant senses, right? Like
right.
trying to form analogies to our own senses. And one of the things that we often don't think about is that plants actually do have a really very fine-tuned sense of sight. And I actually had shown this diagram of these two molecules and asked people if they knew what they were. And one was the pigment in chloroplast, chlorophyll, right, which receives sunlight. And the other were the photoreceptors in our human eyes, right, that help mm-hmm. us sense light. They're basically the same exact shape.
Right.
Molecularly, right? They serve a similar function. So monstera, which is actually interesting, it's a vine normally, right? So mm-hmm. a lot of people see them and they think they grow shrub-like, but really you kind of have to train them
yes.
initially. To
They're
get
totally
them to-
a climbing plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what people don't realize is that monstera usually grow on the tropical forest floor. And so actually they don't want to grow towards the light. They want to grow towards the darkness because what they're in search for is something to climb. And mm-hmm. the tallest thing in the forest to climb are going to be trees. And the space underneath those very tall trees is going to be very dark. And so
wow.
actually they crawl or grow, they're not crawling, but they grow towards the darkness. So they can find the tallest tree, so then they can grow up that tree to reach the light.
And how do we know that?
They've done a few experiments where they give the plant different amounts of certain wavelengths of light,
mm-hmm.
right? And see, very similar to those experiments that we talked about when we talked about hormones and auxin and how the plant mm-hmm. can see the dark side of the plant versus the light side of the plant. And they see that monstera grows kind of opposite to what we would expect in mm-hmm. that they curve towards the darkness rather than away from it.
Wow. So interesting. I think the only other thing I wanted to ask you about, and it might just be an interesting thought for us to kind of leave off on, is VOCs and the ozone.
Yes.
Because they're volatile. And like you said, a VOC that isn't harmful could easily pair with another thing in the air and become harmful. And I think that's what our planet is going through right now. So can you kind of expand on that?
It's a lot of things being emitted in our atmosphere. These include things like methane and carbon monoxide and VOCs, right? Which are often usually called non-methane VOCs, essentially, because methane is also an organic molecule, but it's so much more potent and stronger than other VOCs that it's like put in its own category. But basically, all of these things have very similar traits. They're organic, they're gaseous. And what happens is they often exist in the presence of this secondary set of compounds called the nitrogen oxides, which you might have been called NOx, because it's okay. NO and then an X usually to represent okay. how many O's do they have, how many oxygen molecules. The problem is that these VOCs, methane, carbon monoxide, when they're in the presence of NOx and sunlight, right? So basically during the day
right.
and in cities where we have a lot of human pollution, they interact with one another and swap molecules. And one of the resulting molecules that gets created is ozone. And you might be saying
to yourself, which is O3?
Yes, O3.
Okay.
You might be saying to yourself, wait, like I thought we want to repair the ozone layer. We want ozone. The problem is that we want ozone in the stratosphere, the very top part of our atmosphere. But this ozone gets produced close to human life, which is in what's called the troposphere. So it's often called tropospheric ozone. And mm-hmm. the problem is that it drastically can impact the climate. And it's also an extreme air pollutant and can cause a number of respiratory illnesses. They reduce the ability of plants to photosynthesize. They can damage even animal health in that area. So we really don't want this bad form of ozone, but it's a natural byproduct of the presence of sunlight, NOx, and VOCs and methane.
Gosh. So what's the solution there? It's reducing the methane?
Well, methane is definitely a huge part of the problem because it's mm-hmm. so pollutant and it lasts in the atmosphere for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem because basically the methane that we produce today then lasts 20 years in the atmosphere. And just think of how many ozone molecules can be produced over the course of 20 years of that methane mm-hmm. sitting there waiting to interact with other things. VOCs, right? And you might be saying, well, then what do we do about urban trees, right? Like, right. So is planting urban trees good or is it bad? And what a number of researchers are looking into and urban planners are looking into is thinking more consciously about which species of trees we plant in cities, right? So to plant low VOC emitting trees in cities. But of course, the VOCs that a plant produces are on a scale much smaller than the VOCs we produce through driving our cars and
right.
running our electricity and painting things and cleaning, dry cleaning, and all those other things that produce pollution.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. And I'm excited to see, I don't know if excited is the right word, but I'm very interested to see how that plays out in our lifetime, because it's yeah. our lifetime that this shit is all going to hit the fan with. To steer it back to a less depressing thing, this conversation has been so interesting, but I hope through this conversation, people experience what I experienced in our tree communication class, which is, man, there's so much more going on with plants than we know. And we understand, even scientists, like there's still mm-hmm. studies going on. And to really understand that these plants that we make a home with are smart and complex and are living. They're living, constantly emitting these things and mm-hmm. communicating. And it's also interesting. And I hope everybody, just like every time they hear, every time they smell a rose, they just think of us going, rose, VOC, basil, VOC. Just everything you smell, just say VOC right after.
Yeah.
So the other day it rained. And then right after the rain, I went for a walk and it was the most wonderful smell. Like, you know, that post-rain smell. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that is?
Yeah. Well, so there's multiple different types of post-rain smell. I think there's one post-rain smell that is superior to all others, which is the smell of a forest after it's rained.
Yeah.
And oftentimes what that is the release of VOCs from the soil, not produced by plants, but produced by those fungi and bacteria, right?
And them interacting with water. Mm-hmm. So that smell as well, VOC.
Yes.
Rain, VOC.
Really, all of this is telling you that just VOC is a very general term for a yeah. chemical that can evaporate, basically, right? And be a smell.
It's so interesting. Well, I hope people think about the wood wide web next time they walk in a forest and think VOC next time they smell anything. So you're moving across the country for a new exciting job, but where can our community keep in touch with you and follow up and see all the cool things that you're doing and publishing?
Yeah, so you can follow me and the rest of this very vast scientific communication space on Twitter. There's actually a ton of scientists on Twitter mm-hmm. that are really interested in science communication. So you can follow me there at EcoEvoL, and I'm sure Maria will link to it.
Yes.
And I'm constantly just posting and trying to translate, right, some of this most recent scientific research that comes out for the layman, right? So like, how can we understand this brand new study that scientists are like shocked and talking about? Like, how can everyone else understand what this actually means?
No, you have a gift, Elle. Like, I swear, you get me to understand things I never thought I could understand. So we're so thankful that you're back. I hope that you'll come back on the show once you get settled in California. Yeah, go check Elle out, EcoEvoL on Twitter. And everybody also read The Overstory if you like trees, because it'll make you smile. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Plant friends, I hope your mind was as blown as mine in this conversation. I highly recommend Dr. Barnes is no longer at New York Botanical Garden. I believe she relocated to California. But if you can take her classes, and also if you get the chance to take an online class or an in-person class at New York Botanical Garden, I've taken so many of their courses and I have loved every single one. They're just like jam-packed with amazing information. So thank you again to New York Botanical Garden and Dr. Barnes for this incredible course. I hope you look at the wood wide web under your feet completely differently and that you see trees in a new light. And of course, that this episode helps you keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.